Tuesday, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rob with episode number 291 of Shut Up and Grind. And if you're new to the show, we're all about overcoming obstacles, we're about defying the odds and helping you get whatever it is you want to achieve in this lifetime. So I bring guests from all over the world. I've had guests from 6 different continents and over 50 countries sharing their stories of triumphs over struggle. And today's guest is no different. I actually met this man a couple years ago, came into my gym as a guest, saw him out on the Spartan race course a couple times, just ran into him at Planet Fitness. So I guess we were destined to cross paths and let him share his story with all of you. So we're going to be talking about From Depths to Peaks with Ken Walsh. Welcome to the show, sir. Coach, right as you're sipping your coffee, my bad.
Excited to be here, man. Got my afternoon coffee to get me going, you know.
I love it. All right, so where are you joining us from?
I am at home. I work from home full time. So I'm in East Greenwich. So I'm right up the hill from you, or you're not actually at work right now. But yeah, I'm right up the hill, back up in the hills on the other side of Route 2 from East Greenwich. And so this is where I spend most of my waking days, right? When it comes to work or whatever else is going on. Yeah.
All right. So you work from home. What are you doing?
So these days I'm a senior advanced analytics manager. I work for a company named Medtronic. Medtronic is the largest medical device manufacturer in the world. And I specifically am working on, we have a robot named Hugo that operates on patients in combination with surgeons. And when it does that, it produces massive amounts of data. And I lead the team that takes all of that data and makes sense of it. So awesome. I'm kind of an IT / data nerd. Which was okay with me.
So were you always into that, or is that something that you found later on in life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, we'll probably get into some of it. But, I always did well in school. So school, I was very, very lucky that school was easy to me always. And I think I was always interested in problem solving and leading teams of people to, achieve a goal, whether that be playing sports or coaching sports or even in work, like we talk about leading teams. I had math, science, all of that stuff was really what interested me. And I guess maybe I was drawn to it over my career. I think you just kind of get exposed to it at some point or another and you realize you really love it. And then you just start kind of chasing that path. I think that's what happened with me.
All right. So take me through your high school years. Like how would you, like outside of work, like how would you, athletically, socially, just like, yeah, how would you describe it?
So I think maybe it's maybe just a little bit before that. We'll give folks a background of why I'm here actually. Okay. I was the youngest of 6 kids. I grew up, poor and well, we're on welfare and, much younger than my siblings. My mother was a recovering alcoholic when she had me, and she was kind of brutally molested by a family friend growing up many times. And, so she ended up, with mental illness due to that and addiction issues due to that childhood trauma. And so, I mean, the house was fairly calm, I guess you could say, until about 10 years old. But it was about that time that my brothers and sisters were openly smoking weed and drinking in front of me. There was multiple teenage pregnancies. There was lots of police at the house for fighting and crime and whatever else they were getting themselves into. So just, it was a lot of up and down. And my mother then had developed a form of cancer that wasn't due to cigarette smoking, even though her and my father were very heavy cigarette smokers. And in the process of fighting that, she got introduced to pain pills in the form of opioids. And she was hooked from the start. And that was in the late 80s. They didn't track it, doctor shopping, whatever it was. So she kind of chased that. And that combined with, she was bipolar type 2, that combined with that meant a lot of time in bed over my teenage years, missing sports games, not asking for report cards, just kind of almost there, but not there. Several unsuccessful suicide attempts where she would spend time in Butler Hospital and I'd go to visit her there, shit that a kid shouldn't be dealing with, Rob, right? And so, I started smoking weed and drinking at 14, right? I mean, I think it was the first time I had a chance to do it. It was like, okay, this is what you do. This is what everybody around me does. And I'd go to Thanksgiving and half the family would leave to go smoke weed before dinner and walk down the block, you know, 18 people or whatever. That was just what it was, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I think that's what I started doing. And, you know, before long I was high almost all day, every day, and drinking on the weekends pretty frequently, and kind of led from there into later on in life. But when I was 17, my sister had, I had moved to Fall River and become a heroin addict, and she ended up, you know, prostituting herself and giving a baby up for adoption. And she ended up going to jail for a couple of years and came home, you know, lived back at our house sober, and talked about how hard it was to live in her body, knowing the things she had done to it, right? Because it's just the throes of addiction will make you do things that are just completely against your core values. And she talked about if she ever tried heroin again, that she would take her own life. And she went out one night to Kingstown Bowl in North Kingstown and ran into and used. And the very next morning, she shot herself on the side of Post Road near Quonset.
Oh, my God.
And so, you know, like by that time, like I said, I was smoking all day, every day or whatever. And it's not often they find dead bodies on the side of Post Road in North Kingstown. So it's kind of this huge news across town and really isolating for me. No one knew what to say. So they didn't say anything like those types of things. But so like I kind of just dove deeper and deeper into the drugs and alcohol that I was already moving towards, because obviously I was burying all my emotions and everything I couldn't deal with and figure out into that. But, and I think the most important part about this is that I was excelling in school. I was an all-state soccer player in high school as a junior, led the state in scoring, you know, had a terrible knee injury in between and missed most of my senior year, getting good grades. I dated the pretty girl in school. And when I, we'll talk about, you know, in a little bit, when I speak to schools nowadays, I kind of tell that to say, you know, the kids that you look up to in this school that are the ones who look like they have it all going on, like a lot of those kids have a story too. And it's not all what you think on the outside, you know, and understanding that everyone's got a story is kind of one of my big themes. So, you know, I was excelling. I was from the outside, the all-American kid with no problems. And that kind of, you know, I guess maybe that image helped me perpetuate the drug and alcohol abuse without repercussions.
Wow. So you unpacked a lot there. So yeah. I take notes. I take notes during the shows. All right. So before we get into the how you moved on from it, how were you introduced into the weed and the drinking? Like, I know you said like relatives would do it after dinner and stuff, but how were you personally introduced to it?
I was at a friend's house in the neighborhood. And another one of the kids in the neighborhood had it. He's a year older than us. And we came in, hey, you guys want to smoke? I've got weed or got a joint or whatever, you know. And everyone was like, yeah, let's go. I think there was five of us. It was the first time. And just like I said, it wasn't – there was never a moment in which I thought maybe I shouldn't do this, you know. It was just this is what you do. When you're from where I'm from, this is what you do. That's it. And of course I'm hanging around with kids who are like me, because you're drawn to other people like you, you know, and they were thinking the same thing, you know?
All right. So when did it get to a point where you started numbing from the past hurt using the weed and alcohol?
I that's always blurry, but I think the way I describe it is that, like, the first time you get high, some people smoke weed for the first time, and you know, I'm sure you've heard over the years, they'll say, like, I just didn't like the way I felt. I felt out of control. I never wanted to do it again. And then there are other people who said, like, once I got out of my body and it was, like, high me over here, finally felt like I felt good. I felt free. I felt, you know, I got to a place where I was confident in myself. You know, growing up in a situation, even though I'm doing well in school and on the field and all sorts of stuff like that, I didn't have confidence at all. You would never know that to know me, but I really didn't. And that's based upon your upbringing. A lot of kids who come up through that type of shit, they don't have the confidence. They lose their confidence in who they are.
Can I just try in on that real quick before you finish? Because now I don't know you, But what I know of you, I would have never thought you struggled with confidence. Never. Yeah. And that's a big reason why I love doing this show, because you get to find out things about people that you would have never thought it was possible. Like I've seen the way you train. I see the way you carry yourself. Like I would have never have thought that.
Yeah. And you know, and today I would say that's not the case. Because today the inside matches the outside. Yes. Today I'm authentically me. Today I wear my emotions on my sleeve. Today I love the world and want to help everybody. Today I cry when I'm happy or sad. Today, you know what I mean? I'm proud of myself when I look in the mirror after all of the change I've gone through. And because of that, I'm confident. And so I am, you know, in today's world, like if you get to know me and you don't, you'll understand that I'm kind and accepting and whatever. Yes, you know, I'm brash. I wear loud colors, blah, blah, blah. But like, that's just my personality. That's who I am. But if back in the day, you know, you would have seen me, you would have thought I was confident from afar. And I was petrified, like something very simple, like presenting in front of the class in seventh or eighth grade. I mean, I would fake like I was sick on those days so I wouldn't go to school. You know, just, and now, you know, I run large teams and large meetings, 100 people. I stand in front of, you know, multiple hundreds of people and I speak, right? It's totally different. And what I filled that space with for many years is what I call false bravado. You saw confidence, but it was fake. Like I was going to be a hard ass. I was going to show you this rough exterior so that I wouldn't let you close because everybody close to me hurt me. And so, you know, when I started on my journey to really do self-discovery and work on myself and try to, you know, attack those parts and do a ton of counseling and stuff like that, you know, who did I want to be, Rob, right? Like, what do I want the world to see in me? You know, I had other people kind of come to me a couple times and say, you know, like the person you are today, I love, like I gravitate towards you, but like, you're kind of an asshole before, like you were my friend, but like, you just like, you were rough, man. And like, for no reason. And that's the no confidence thing, you know?
See, I want to expand on that a little. Like, I'm not challenging what you're saying. I just want to give an additional perspective, you know, because like, I'll never question anyone's lived experiences. But like, people think I have zero empathy because I'm brash as well. And but I'm hard on people so they reach their goals, so they believe in themselves, so they find their confidence, and so they believe in themselves more. That's why I don't give in to their excuses, and I don't let them you know, talk badly about themselves. I'm like, I'm hard on you because I care about you, because I know you struggle living in your own skin. I know you struggle with seeing your reflection in the mirror, and I know you struggle with dealing with your past pains and your past traumas. That's why I'm hard on you, so you can believe in yourself.
Yeah, and I am the same way, because, you know, obviously nowadays, you know, a lot of people reach out when they're struggling. I always put it out there. Reach out to me. Let's talk. Let's get coffee. I'll go to dinner. I'll go to lunch or breakfast or whatever. Like, people struggle with mental illness or addiction, those types of things. But I don't put up with bullshit from them. Yes. You know, meaning like, listen, I'm here to give you my time and I will go through the fire with you, but don't bullshit me. Right. And if you're not going to give me everything, this isn't going to work, because I know what it takes to come from that place. And it does take everything. You know, and so some people, that rubs them the wrong way, and I'm okay with that. But like you said, I'm being hard on you because I believe in you, because I have ultimate empathy and compassion for you. And I want you to realize your potential. And that could be in any space in life. And in order to do that, we all know we need to be challenged. Challenged by someone that loves us and sees us and hears us. And when you have that connection, like what you have with a lot of people, you get results, because when people feel the support like that, they will go and out of their comfort zone. They will continue to push because they like the leadership you bring. Right. And that's why you're good at what you do.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about how people suffer from mental issues and they suffer in silence. And so people like us, who aren't afraid to come out and talk. Like, I was just a guest on the show with my friend Portia called The Grief Granter. And we were talking about that, about you know, because like I shared my current circumstance of what's going on. Like, I don't want to take the focus off of you, but she was like, you know, it was very, very strong of you to share that, to talk about what you're going through. I said, yeah, because it's real life. It's what happened. Like, this is what I'm currently going through. Why would I not share it? I'm not going to get up on this show and act like I'm driving a Mercedes and, you know, living in a mansion. It's like, that's not where I am right now. I'm still on the come up, and I have no problem sharing my journey, because vulnerability isn't weakness. Vulnerability is strength. It's the ultimate strength. But you can get up in front of another human being, especially as a man, and tell an emotional story. That's the ultimate strength.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right, man. I mean, we're so aligned on that. It took me a long time to realize that, and I almost died because of that, right? Like, that's not the way I was raised. And, you know, I didn't talk about anything. You know, I don't remember crying when my mom and dad told me my sister passed. I remember going to get high. I was taking bong hits, I think, within 5 minutes of that. You know, like, and then there, you know, other things that happened in life, and it's just, that was my go-to. I had no coping mechanisms emotionally to deal with any of that, to talk about any of that, to whatever. So I just hid it away and buried it. And as the years would go by, it would be catching up with me to the point where I almost ended up dead. And so when I sit in front of a, you know, East Greenwich health class, I speak to all the health classes every year there, and I tell them their story, the senior health classes. And I say, listen, you're going to see me tear up and fight back tears. You know, this is emotional for me. This is my pain. But I am willing to come up here and show you that this guy who looks fit, looks like a bigger guy, looks like he has it all going on, right? That ain't the case. I'm, you know, it doesn't discriminate. I'm not what you think of when you think of an addict. I'm not what you think of when you think of someone who struggles with bipolar type 2 disorder. Right. So, but they need to see you as that person to understand that everyone's got a story. And if that for me is being emotional and vulnerable and connecting with people on their level, because like you said, like, people being afraid to do that for the fear others will judge them, it's not being a real man. A real man is being who you are inside and out, right? Without fear of people judging you. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to judge me for doing, using my story or doing what I do to help other people, if you're going to judge me, I don't need you on my side.
Yes.
You know, I don't need you there, man. You're not on my journey, right? You're, and I'm not going to spend time negative with dealing with you or worrying about you or all that other stuff, right? I'm past all that, right? I'm here to use my stories to inspire and help. And there's a certain amount of freedom that comes with that. What I used to say is I was always afraid that my story was owning me, because I would speak about it here or there. And I live in East Greenwich. I've got kids in school. This is a perfect town, right? People are going to talk about me. I'm worried about who's going to find out about that. If I'm on this little thing here, or a speaking engagement with 10 people, you know, one of the parents of the kids I coach. And I got to the point where my story was owning me, and I couldn't go any further like that. I had to own my story, and the freedom that came with owning my story was more than I ever could have imagined. And I use that to relate to people, because you talked about people who are struggling with any different issue they might have. And owning that is powerful. When that owns you, you're kind of stuck in prison, right? But when you own it, this is me. This is what I struggle with. These are my things. They're all out on the table. Let's go get them. And then I think that's when you find success. And you, I'm sure you're, you know, you see that same thing too, right? And when you see that happen for people, it's emotional for me. I know it's probably emotional for you. Like, I just love to see people break out of their shell and like that new person kind of emerge. Yeah, it's nice.
So on the last show, Portia asked me again about, she's like, you know, how do you find the courage to share all your vulnerable stories? And I, without missing a beat, I say, because I don't care what people think about me. I'm not worried about judgment. I'm not worried about any of that. I am unapologetically me. This is what you're going to get. And like, people in the gym, they know if they ask me a question, they're going to get the brutally honest answer. It's like, I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. One of my track athletes was like, you know, I don't understand why I'm not progressing. I said, because you're lazy and you don't train hard enough. you know, again, without missing a beat. Like, if you train harder, if you took this serious, if you put the work in, your performance would reflect that. I'm like, but you're not doing that. And that's not me being a jerk. That's not me on a power trip. I care about that kid. I want that kid to reach his goals. He wants to compete at the next level in college. I want to see him do that. I want to see his headlines in the newspaper. And I'm not going to be there. I mean, and we're not going to experience that if I coddle him. Now, to the other side, to, like, because you said it too, our styles aren't for everyone, but that's okay. It's like there are people that need a gentler approach. There are people that need to have their backs padded. That's fine. They're not my target audience. You know, my target audience are people who are in their head. They can't get out of their own way, and they need someone this way. Look, here is the path. So, you're off the path again, back on the path. Like, some people need that, and that's where our styles come in. It's like the second you try to be someone else, your audience is going to see right through you, and they're going to gravitate away from you.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's always a good clarification to make in a situation like this, where you and I are trying to help people, and we're being vulnerable and sharing, and then we say, you know, I don't care what anybody else thinks. That doesn't mean other people who are doing things that have negative consequences in their life, affecting people in their life negatively, like, those people need to care about what they're doing and what other people think, right? Like, you know, so it's like there is a difference of when you should care and shouldn't care about what.
Yeah, no, I meant from a judgment perspective. Like, I don't care about people judging me. Like if I say right now, currently, myself and my oldest daughter, we live with my mom. I can openly say that I don't care what people have to think about me. Yeah. I don't live by society standards. Right now, I'm doing what I have to do to move myself forward. So I have no problem saying that on any public forum, in person. It is what it is. It's where I currently am. If somebody else has a problem with that, that's their problem. That's not mine.
Yeah, I agree, man. And I think, honestly, that's how you make the greatest impact. And when you get to a point in your life where that is the most important thing to you, is the impact you're making on this world. Like I said, there's a sense of freedom that comes along with being you and authentically you. And not having to worry about the noise. I spent too much of my life worrying about the noise. And some of those times I should have been, because I was hurting other people with my actions. But today, you know, I'm confident in who I am. I love myself, and I know I'm doing what I'm doing for the right reasons. And for me, that goes a long way. It helps me sleep at night.
So take me through the steps. Well, take us through the steps of how you got to where you are today. So, you know, you're using alcohol and weed to numb the pain. When, what was your awakening moment?
Yeah, so, you know, that's teenage years, right? I think, you know, you think about like acid and shrooms and other stuff like that I would come across in high school. We were doing that. And, you know, there were, I mean, many, many days where I would wake up and smoke weed before I went to school, you know, my senior year. Like, that was the thing. And maybe kind of sneak away at lunch and do it again. So, but school was, like I said, easy for me, really. Like, I was in AP classes and honors classes, and then I would like drop them into the regular classes just so that I could just sleep through them, basically, because my mom and dad weren't asking me any tough questions, right? So, like, I was in almost all AP classes at one time. And, you know, I think I was ranked top 10 out of like 360 kids in my class when I entered high school. And I think I would finish at like 57th or something. But the point being is that I was not realizing my potential, even though I was, quote, doing good. You know, no one asked me if I was going to go to college in my house. I just knew it was something that I needed to do for myself. I knew that I had a gift, you know, that I was good at school, and that if I wasted that, it would be, you know, and I didn't want the place I grew up in. You know, I wanted more. And so I applied to one school, University of Rhode Island, and because it was right down the road, they partied a lot. I knew that was pretty cool, because I was partying there when I was a high school senior. So I was like, okay, we'll go down there and stuff like that, you know. And I walked into my dorm room on the first day of school, and there was a girl in my dorm room talking to my roommate. Her name was Sarah. And on April 24th, we'll celebrate 20 years of marriage.
Awesome.
So she is she's
take time.
She's the only reason, you know, I'm talking to you today. She stuck with me. She believed in me when I had nobody else. You know, I was homeless at one point with nowhere to go. And she'd help out. She'd buy me groceries. She was buying me clothes. I mean, just like she just knew that I had a lot of potential. And I was broken, you know, flat out. I was broken. I ended up having to leave school because my financial aid fell through. And I was just kind of floating. You know, my parents had lost the house. The bank foreclosed and they got divorced. I mean, I had nowhere to go. And my sisters both stepped in. I'm really close with both of them. And, you know, one had me in her basement. The other one then moved me into her house and gave me a bedroom and said, if you go back to school, you know, you can stay here for free. Believed in me, you know. And so I went back to school and finished with a business degree. Sarah had already been out a couple of years. I moved in with her. But, you know, when I was in school, drinking every night, heavily smoking all the time, blah blah blah, all that type of stuff. When I came back to school, I was working a full-time job plus more and going and partying full-time. I mean, but just I've always been a workhorse, right? Just always worked, never afraid to put the hours in or whatever, even though I was high most of the time. But yeah, so I moved to Massachusetts, started building a career, you know, in corporate America, and so did she. We were living together, ultimately got married, had a couple kids, blah blah. I went to, it was right before that, I got a call that my mom, when I was 27, that my mom, 2005, that my mom was found unconscious, not breathing. And they resuscitated her, but she was too far gone, and they had to let her go. Now, my mom had spent those years since I left, you know, the house, 18, 9 years, like, alone, really, living alone, an addict. Isolated, chasing pills. I pretty rarely talked to her. I had a lot of resentment and anger that I didn't know how to get rid of or let go of. And so after that, you know, I got an MBA, went back to got an MBA. Like I was just, you know, in my all the time, all the while, my drug use and drinking was getting more and more. I turned to cocaine a lot and uppers kind of all through that journey. And then in the 10 years after my mom's death, looking back on it, I didn't know it at the time because I think people need to understand this. When you're going through that, it takes years and years to get to your worst point. It's not like you wake up one day and you're like, oh God, it's bad. It's getting worse and worse, how often you're doing it, how much you're doing it, that type of stuff. But if you're doing well in work and you're getting raises and promotions and blah, 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 the addiction will use that as reason why you can continue with your hurtful behaviors, you know? And so things were, you know, getting worse and worse. And then, you know, I had a couple of two kids, they're 14 and 12 now, but I had a couple of kids, 2009, 2012. And then, there would be an event that happened in 2012 that would change everything for me. But I'll stop there and see if you have any questions about what I just said.
No, go ahead. Keep flowing.
Sorry. I got, nose is running a little bit there. I get a little teary eyed talking about Sarah. So 2011, I was on Wheel of Fortune and I won $47,000. So that's my claim to fame, by the way. Nice. And I had a chance to win $1 million on the final puzzle because I brought the million dollar wedge with me and stuff. So like I solved the puzzle and there was like a 1 in 24 shot. There was like $1 million in the envelope he chose or I chose, whatever. And, it wasn't $1 million, but the funniest part about this is that the puzzle that I solved in the final round was happy hour.
Mm.
And of course, you know, I enjoy happy hour. I was joining in plenty of them, too many of them. I remember like coming back and talking to my friends and I was telling them like, oh yeah, happy hour. And they were like, oh yeah, fitting. Oh, makes total sense. Oh, blah, blah, blah. You know? And I was just kind of thinking like, what the fuck, man? Like, really? You know, so it's like you look back on moments like that and you're kind of like, okay, like maybe you should have picked up on the, you know, the hints. So anyway, 2012, I get a call. My father's in the hospital. My father was, he coached a lot of my soccer teams. He coached my brothers and sisters teams, baseball, soccer, you name it. And he was the guy, he ran the soccer league, North Kingstown Soccer Association, like way back when. He just committed himself to like his kids and the town. And he was just this like giant of a man. And he just like, when I was kind of drifting off, like I was still doing well in school and on the sports field, so like he really didn't know what to say. He kind of was just like, oh well, he's not giving me hell like my other kids did. And but we were close, you know what I mean? Like we were just tight. We just, he was my man, you know, and my role model, the person I looked up to. So I got a call, he's in the hospital, and that he had pneumonia, down South County Hospital. Went down there and I was in the room when they diagnosed him with stage 4 lung cancer. They told him, you know, he had 3 to 6 months to live if the pneumonia did not spread to the other lung, because if it did, it would kill him. He was a very heavy cigarette smoker. He was drafted into Vietnam. He smoked Lucky Strikes, so no filtered cigarettes for however many years. He was 65 when he passed. And within a week and a half, it spread to his other lung and it wiped him out. I call my father's death nowadays the greatest gift he ever gave me, because he gave me clarity. He gave me the reason, the way to look at myself and answer tough questions. Finally, you know, I'd been lying to myself for so long that I was successful, that blah, blah, blah. And in a way, because I grew up on welfare, I grew up dirt poor. So there was a lot of fighting about money. And like in my mind, if I had the nice car and the big house and I could put food on the table and all it provide for my family, like I was successful, right? But I was there. I reached what I thought was success and I was miserable. I was close to death, you know? I was depressed. I was using more drugs and alcohol than I ever had. And one morning I came into the hospital and then I asked the nurse, you know, how's my dad doing? And she said he had a rough night. You know, he was hitting the buzzer. We came in there and he was just filled with like anxiety, you know, like regret. It just said he would like, impact us the way we had already lost other people. And he wouldn't have time with me or with his grandkids or all of that stuff. And she said he was like almost convulsing, like violently. And they had to shoot him with sedative to make him go to sleep. And I was like, the way she described it and what I was seeing, right, all of the sights and sounds and shit that was happening around me, like, I was like, I'm looking at my own death. Like, I'm going to die filled with regret that I repeated the cycle, you know, that my father's not going to be proud of me, you know? Like, he didn't know all my secrets, but if he did, he wouldn't have been proud of the man that I was. And, you know, he passed away and people reached out, oh, your dad was like a second father to me because of his coaching and blah, 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 like hundreds of people. And I'm like, how do I leave a legacy like that? What are people going to say about me when I'm gone? And it's not a contest with him. It's just, What are they going to say about me? And it was the first time in years, all these years, that I was willing to like take inventory of the answers to those questions, honestly. And I was destroyed. I was absolutely destroyed. So that was my journey. I started. I stopped drinking and drugging for a year and a half. I lost 50 pounds. I was huge. Big face and blah, 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 you know. And I started running. I ended up in a CrossFit gym. But I still was like, hey, you know, I can just drink. Like, if I don't do drugs, I can just drink, though. Like, I'm normal, like everybody else, you know. And then I'd have 4 or 5 drinks. I'd go find drugs, and then I would binge. So I wasn't an everyday user, but I would binge hardcore. And that happened for a few more years. And finally, I got to a point where I was scared I was going to die. I didn't want to die. I had too much to live for. So I asked for help. I is the most courageous thing I've ever done. I would not be here talking to you if I didn't ask for help. And I think for me, because I was raised myself basically since I was 14, I had all the answers. I always knew what to do. I always, look at me, I'm successful. I've done all of this stuff coming from this. And it was the one thing that I couldn't do. I would promise myself I wouldn't drink and drug, and I couldn't stick to it. And it took a while of doing that before I was like, I'm powerless, man. I have no idea. and I need to go talk to somebody, and I need to bring people into this like very private disaster of my life. And I'm a proud person. And it was the hardest thing I've probably ever done, but saved my life.
Wow. That's incredible. Like I said, you never know what people have been through, you know, and again, that's the beauty of doing this show. And like, there's a lot of similarities in there too. Like my dad passed in 2019. He got sick in January of that year, and he ended up passing that November. He had stage 4 heart failure. And just throughout that process, because like I had dabbled in and out of speaking, but I never really pursued it. Like I wanted to start a podcast. I remember this was in October of 2019. I was talking with him and said, you know, I think I'm going to go full force with podcasting. And he's like, you know, just make it happen. Just that one sentence, just make it happen. And that just put everything into motion. And so like with every show that I do, and when I listen to people talk about their parents, like it chokes me up too, you know, because it's like I witnessed it. Like we watched him die. Like we watched the blood leave his face. Like it's such a powerful thing. But like you said, there is a silver lining, because at some point we're all going to die. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like having that realization, and I knew as he was getting sicker and sicker, I was like, this could be the end. So I started mentally preparing for it ahead of time, you know, before it was imminent that we were going to lose him. But, you know, my first thought was, I interviewed a guy, Steve Berlach, on this show a couple of years ago, and his father was killed in Vietnam while his mom was pregnant with him. Oof. So he never knew his father. I'm like, how can I be sad? I was 45 when my dad died. You know what I mean? So he left behind 45 years of memories that this guy has never experienced in his life.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he had a stepfather. I know, and some stepfathers can step in and be that dude, you know, but to have that bond with your biological father, like that's an amazing bond. And I'm talking about the real daddy, the real dad that's there for you.
Yeah.
You know, not two people who just made a kid, you know, and
right.
just going through that, there's so much that you can take away, excuse me, on the positive side. Like this show is called Shut Up and Grind, because I used to watch that man in his garage every single day just making stuff happen. He would come home with the most mangled of vehicles and somehow he would fix them and I'd be driving that car. Like he just made stuff happen out of nothing. No matter what he was working on, he figured it out.
Yeah.
And then that was instilled in all of us, because like myself and my siblings, like we all have that same drive.
Yeah.
And it stemmed from watching him.
Yeah. And you know, I say to people, because I'll tell people my story or whatever, you know, something like that. And they'll say, oh, well, mine wasn't as bad as that, but, and I'm like, oh, whoa, it's not a contest, you know, like
exactly.
If we lost somebody we love and it imprinted on us and we've been through that, like we have a connection and, you know, we have a shared story. It's not, you know, that's what it's like, even in like sobriety, people are like, oh, I have 9 years. Oh, well, I only got four, like only four, like what the fuck? Like, I just don't like that. I like, how can we find connection as opposed to like, you know, going against each other? And people don't mean it when they say that, right? Like you were like, well, he's never met his dad. And I had my dad for 45 years. And those are both valid points. But you guys are both without a dad now.
Yeah.
And that affects you to some degree to change your life that you're talking about it today or, you know, a month ago, whatever that is, or 2 years ago, right? So I think I always try to say that, like, let's not do that. Let's find the common ground. Let's find the love in the middle, right? And find how we connect over these things that affect us so greatly, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, so I think from there, what happened was I ran the Boston Marathon and I raised money for the Samaritans of Rhode Island. I sit on the board. They do suicide intervention, prevention, stuff like that. And I raised money. And I remember I was working at an IT consulting company. And I was talking about, you know, the person who runs Samaritans had said to me, okay, well, if you're going to raise money, you've got to tell your story. Like, we talk about suicide here, you know, because with my mom, it's like, well, what was it? Was it suicide or overdose? Or we don't know. It's both. I mean, is it overdose, suicide? So it's like, it's murky. We don't know. But it's like my mom and my sister, of course, my mom had all of these, you know, attempts that were not successful. You know, I'd find a suicide note at my house and we find her at a hotel a day later in Warwick or something, you know? And I was like fucking 13, You know, like, are you like, you know what I mean? Like, well, you can't like go overnight, like worrying where your mom is and not be fucked up from that. This is not, you know what I mean? It's just not possible. Like, what else would I expect? How else would I come out? You know, like, if I didn't have a counselor, people weren't putting intervention in front of me and people weren't, you know what I mean? Because we didn't do that back then. You didn't like lose somebody and then everyone would bring a counselor to you or start, your parents would bring counselors. You know, if my kids lost their mom tragically, I'd have them in counseling like the next week, right? And we'd be talking about like, how do we deal with these things? How can we like, you know? So it's like, but then, you know, so I ran and she was like, well, we share these. I was like, share that? Like, no way. I don't talk about that. And then, because nobody knew that about me, I was afraid I would get judged, especially at work, corporate America or whatever. So anyway, so I put together my story and I trusted her. She's like, you'd be surprised what you're gonna get. You know, I put it out in my company. My boss and the president of the company, there's about 300 people in the company, they both came to me and said they lost a sister to suicide. The boss, I mean, the president said, I want to make a sizable donation if you put the company name on your shirt, which I did, right? And he said, because that would be in memory of her. And I had my mom's, my sister's name, and then my best friend's father passed from suicide when we were 16. I had his name on there too. And so, but when I put it out there and people came to me, and then other people in the company were like, oh, me too. Oh, this story. Oh, my mom, someone struggles, all this stuff. I was like, this thing that is so isolating in my world is the thing that actually drives connection for me that I needed.
Absolutely.
Once I shared that stuff, people came to me. They were gravitated towards that because they were like, I've never met anybody who has something. A situation like me, and I was thinking the same thing, and now here we were, and we worked together. We know we got each other's back. The relationship is there. I'm like, this is great. And the most important thing about it all is that I started healing, and so did other people. And once I got that, a little bit of that, I was like, I am on my journey. Let's go. And from there, when I went to get a psychiatric evaluation, they told me that I was bipolar type two, like my mom, because it's genetic. And I never thought for whatever reason that I was bipolar type two. And then they also said, you know, 20% of people with bipolar type two die by suicide. And it's the highest correlated mental illness with addiction. I'm like, oh shit, everything makes sense now. No wonder I couldn't stop, you know, like my disease was driving me there to self-medicate. Once I got on medication for my bipolar, I'm sleeping better, like blah, blah, blah. And then, like, the urges almost went away almost entirely. It was like magic. And of course, since then, I've had to, you know, this is many years ago. This is 6 years ago, 7 years, 8 years ago that I got on my medication for the first time, maybe even nine. I've had to tweak and change. And just, I don't even know, 3 months ago, I changed the milligram on one of my medications. As I get older, my testosterone levels go down, right? My other hormones change. Like that is something that might continue to happen. But I had no idea the way that I feel today, I could feel even 2 years ago. And then 2 years before that, I didn't know I could feel that good. And then 2 years before that. So it's like I'm thriving. And you know what they told me? They were like, well, I was like, well, where do I go from here? Because people are like, well, what did you do when you were diagnosed? And I was like, I was pumped. I had a reason. I
You
was
had an answer.
searching for a reason for so long, right? And like finally I had it. And they were like, well, this is what you're gonna do. And if you give me like if you have a prescription, like I'm like you. Oh yeah, I'm not all over it, right? This is what I need to do. Oh, I need to work out vigorously, you know, 6, 7 days a week, 5 to 7 days a week. My sleep needs to be regular. I need to eat clean. I need my medication. I need a counselor. I need a psychiatrist. I need all of these things, right? And they told me if I do all of these things, I can thrive in life. Well, okay, that's all you need to tell me, right? You know, because I had lived in such a dark place for so long. There were so many times that I just didn't care to be here anymore. I wasn't actively suicidal, but I was passively suicidal, putting enough drugs and alcohol in my body in one binge to kill a small elephant, you know? And then not being able to fall asleep after because I'd done God only knows how much coke. So I'd take like a sleeping pill to put me to sleep. And I remember like nodding off and thinking to myself, you might not wake up. And very next thought would be like, oh, well, you know? And then now, I'm like, so that I shared the story, you know, inside my company. And then I started speaking around the state for Samaritans. And then I got hooked in with people in East Greenwich. And I started speaking to the health classes there. And now I've been, you know, I speak everywhere, podcasts, all this stuff. I speak inside of work, sharing my story, which is a big no-no in corporate America, but I'm attacking the stigma there, you know, and I'm kind of going to all these places wherever I can get maybe one ear that just needs a message of hope. That's it, you know, and you know what I'm talking about. I mean, hope.
Yes.
Oh, man, there's no better drug than that, right? Hope
so
is
true.
A powerful thing, man. You know, so.
Yeah, it's true. It's like when people come into the gym, usually it's not just about fitness. Usually it's something else, whether they're coming off a divorce, they're changing jobs, you know, like there's usually some deeper reason why they're there. And when we uncover that reason, and then I share my stories with them as well. Like one of my PT clients came in, you know, I could tell she had been crying, and I was like, let's go in the office. She said that she and her daughter were in a bad car accident, and her daughter had ankle damage, and the doctors told her she wouldn't run again. And she wouldn't walk again. And I said, don't you dare accept that. I said, don't you dare accept that. And I went into my story, like how this podcast even started was about my knee injury and being told I would never run a jump again. You know, so I was like, I said, don't put that in her head. Like she's 17 years old. You keep reinforcing to her. It's the doctor's job to piece her back together. It's her job to heal.
Yeah.
I said, she has to be in charge of that. And yeah. I think it was 4 months later, she was walking again. But yeah. I told her, I was like, don't accept it. If you accept the diagnosis, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
But if you tell yourself, no, I can fight. People have been told they have 6 months to live, and 10 years later, they're still here.
Yep.
You know, so healing is healing, like, or diagnosis from a doctor. I'm not saying don't listen to your doctors. I'm just saying healing is from within you.
Yeah. And I mean, your body's capable of crazy things, right? And so like you talked about your knee. So 2011, I glossed over that. I playing beer league softball, tore my MCL clean through, my PCL, dislocated my kneecap, a bunch of cartilage. There was multiple more things in there. And they told me, you know, they give me a 10 to 15% chance that I could ever walk without a limp again. Certainly not doing what the fuck I'm doing nowadays. But I'm probably just like you, right? If you tell me I can't do something, that's the most motivating thing you can ever do with me. Like, I take that shit personal.
I'm like, challenge accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Oh, what? Yeah. And then, you know, and then it's like, okay, then I'll put that work in. So, and that also is a way to motivate, too. I mean, you know that. Depending on once you get to know somebody really well, you get to understand how to motivate them, right? Some people, if you challenge them and tell them they can't do something, it's the best way to get them to do something. You got to push the button, right? But it works. And you know, I'm sure you're probably the same way considering where you came from and your knee and that type of stuff. Like, don't tell me that. That's the last thing, you know, or maybe tell me that, right? I guess probably that was the best thing that happened to me, that I was told that. Anyway.
All right. So I know you got a heart out at 2:30. So give us some final words and let people know where they can find you if they want to follow you.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, you can find me on, I'm on Facebook. Ken Walsh, I think I'm KDubs14 on Instagram. You want to follow me? I will give out my number because I mean what I say when I say if you're struggling or someone you love is struggling, I am willing to talk and jump in and help. I do a lot of it and I love to do it. It's healing for me to be able to help other people. So my number is 508-330-2279 and feel free to reach out. I would love to help. And like we were talking about before, my message is hope. I've been in places where I didn't think that I could have the life I have today. I didn't wake up and have it. I worked my ass off for a lot of years to get where I'm at, right? And so if you're not up for the challenge, I can't offer you, right? A better tomorrow. You know, you're going to have to say, this is the most important thing to me in my life. And you're going to need to not make excuses. And you're going to need to say, I'm going to have to evaluate everything I thought I knew about how to live in this world. And if you can prioritize right and put those things first, You know, everybody's heard the analogy where you know the oxygen mask, and you got to put yours on first before you help other people. And we say that, I'm not sure we live it. But for me right now, my family and my friends know my exercise has to happen. I have to have that time. My sleep has to be regular, and it has to happen. If that means I'm going to be up late certain nights doing some sort of event or whatever, I might have to pass on it, right? I don't put myself in places that are dangerous for me when it comes to my drug and alcohol addiction, even though I've been in recovery for several years. Counselors, psychiatrists talking about a lot of shit you don't want to talk about. So you have to put yourself entirely first in all of those different areas. And if you do that and I do that, my wife and my boys and you and the people listening to this and the people I coach and the people I talk to, they get the best of me. And if everyone gets the best of me, someone will latch onto the story. My kids will be happier because I'm a better dad. My wife will be happier because I'm a better husband. And I will, like the exercise specifically, right? Like that angst that kind of builds sometimes. Just to be able to get rid of that is peaceful to me. So find your things, know that there is hope, know that you're going to have to work your ass off, but know if you do, it's there for you.
That's awesome, man. This was a great talk. Like I said, what I knew of you, I wasn't expecting this, you know, not at all. So thanks for reaching out, because he reached out to me and asked about being on the show, and I'm glad you did. I'm definitely going to have you back on. And with you being right up the road, we should talk about collaborating, but we can save that for another day.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Absolutely. This was great. Thanks for having me. Like I said, I'd love to be able to spread that message, and I can't wait to work with you going forward, brother.
Awesome, man. All right, take care. Enjoy the rest of your
day. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
You've been listening to Shut Up and Grind. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from this show. Robert has over 20 years experience pouring his knowledge and expertise at many events in the service and fitness industry, as well as secondary schools and universities. He has a true passion for helping others break through the barriers that are holding them back. To book Robert B. Foster to speak or to reach out, go to robertbfoster.com. Till next time, shut up and grind.